I see none. So we're going to go ahead and go on to item three, which is the meat of the deal. We're going to try to go through today's presentation. We'll get through sort of all the intro little stuff, and then Jenna does all the heavy lifting. About a third of the way into Jenna's, we'll take a break, you know, 5-10 minutes to just give everybody a chance to brain break or water break or whatever you need. And with that, we're going to go ahead and jump in. It looks like we're still missing a couple of rookies, but that's okay. So today, this is the first time we've done this, and thank you, Charlotte. Charlotte was probably one of the first new members that we brought in, and she described it as like drinking from a water fire hose. And, you know, not only was she the first kind of new person that we had, but she also came in that compressed cycle, and it was COVID. And I'm like, okay, lots of things that I heard, and we've heard from other chairs of like, there's got to be a better way to do this. There is so much work, as you guys have already seen, that we have to do every meeting to just keep things moving, that you don't always have the ability to get perspective and give everybody the whole picture. So that's what today's about. And we think it's going to be valuable to our long-term members as long as our new folks. And we'll definitely be interested for comments afterwards. Come on in, Suji. We'll definitely be interested from comments from everybody afterwards as we tweak this and try to do something new by it. So we're going to give you an overview of I'm going to give you an overview of kind of what we're doing. Then Pam's going to explain the sponsor role, which is sort of a unique thing if you're not familiar with this kind of process. We're going to Water Development Board's going to kind of walk through. We're lucky to have Tressa here in the room today. And then you can see the technical consultant's going to roll through quite a few things, hopefully in a way that makes sense, right? We're just going to, who is everybody? What is our region even? And then what was the old plan? What changed? What's going forward? Okay, next slide, please. All right, so in general, our group's organized according to state laws and our own bylaws. There's a lot of laws that came straight down from the legislature, and from that, there was other direction they gave to the Water Development Board, who then created rules for us to go by. In addition to that, we have our own bylaws that dictate how we have a chair, a vice chair, a secretary, or admin committee, how we do those elections. Those are set up currently where those are done at the first meeting in January. Also through the state process is who's a voting member, which is all the roles that you have. Those of y'all been involved, we just, for example, just created a new voting member role. That's what Christina's in for large cities, and Anthony's role has been reclassified as small cities. We also have liaisons, which are things that we can add and delete. These are liaisons with our area regions, because again, many, if you're not on a watershed boundary community, it generally means you're split in more than one region. And so it's helpful for us to collaborate with our adjacent regions. We have non-voting members that participate. You may not always notice, but we have non-voting members from the Corps, from FEMA, from Texas State Soil, several other groups that either can feed us information and or be liaisons with us, like the Water Development Board or GLO or TCQ. So there's a lot of people involved. You may not ever, if you're ever, you know, bored sitting in a meeting, look at all the other people who are on the call sometime. It's an interesting group that typically joins us. And generally, you'll see some of those other members come in, GLO or some other folks, to present to us and help explain the collaboration they're doing behind the scenes. I strongly encourage you guys to review the bylaws that are posted on our website. I believe they're still there. I haven't looked on the new website. For two reasons. One, to understand how we work. And it talks about attendance and alternate sections. If there's anything that I'm really passionate about, it's attendance. If you can't be here, your alternate needs to be here. And if they can't be here, that should be a rarity. So think twice of not maybe choosing an alternate that when you miss it, they're probably going to miss for the exact same reasons, right? If they're the duplicate you and they're also going to be in the training, maybe not the best alternate for you. It's really important that you're here and that you represent the roles that you represent, not just listed on the website, but you're here in the meetings and you're engaged. It also helps us keep moving productively forward. If you miss a meeting, look at the slides, review the minutes. Every time we have to back up and rehash something, it bogs us down and it sometimes adds confusion to where we are in the process. It also talks about things that we're just required to have, like codes of conduct and grounds for removal, which includes attendance. And then start thinking about possible updates. We all kind of got thrown together during COVID, and all the regions got a go-by set template of bylaws from the Water Development Board to just get us started. Most of us adopted those just exactly as they are. Logistically, there's some things that Pam and I notice that are just clunky. Some of that's like, why are we electing in January? But then we just for people who might have been in the group in July. And so just syncing up some of those things. I doubt any of y'all are nerdy enough that you care about what's happening. But if you notice something, let Pam and I know. Otherwise, we're probably going to start a little work group offline with our attorney, representative, and Water Development Board, and then present some red line recommendations to help sync some things up and also just make it not so cumbersome and bureaucratic if we don't need to be. So that's our group. There's a certain amount of that. Again, we are founded sort of under state law. State law is what dictates that because we're multi-county, most of y'all can be remote, but we have to have a public space. The presiding officer of the meeting has to be present in the public space. That's why we function the way that we function. Thank God for technology that just makes us work. So there's a lot of things. If you have a question and you think it's weird, ask. Sometimes it's really hard and awkward, but it's something we're legally obligated to do. So we can at least let you know that. And with that, we'll go ahead and go to the next slide. Meeting preparation, attendance expectations, review the agenda and the packet. Surprised we didn't get 7 emails that told us we attached the wrong slides. Try to do that ahead of time. Also, if you notice something big, like we've had some controversial items, feel free to give us a heads up. Like, I do not like what y'all are doing about future rainfall, and I'm going to want to discuss that so that we don't just catch our consultant flat-footed in the meeting. They can start prepping research if you have something particular you need to know about. It's a burden, guys, to be in this role. It's not just show up at the meeting every month. It's doing some prep. It's being prepared. And if you don't think that's what you wanted to do, then, you know, do your best to try to engage. I think it'll make the meetings go better if you're prepared coming in. Do your best to stay engaged throughout the meeting so you're not asking us something that we did 10 slides ago. But please, let's go back to a little bit more decorum of raise your hand, your virtual hand, and wait to be acknowledged before you start speaking up. We're starting to lose a little bit of the decorum where we're having people in the room here or people on the slide and people start to talk over each other. So let's try to remember it's a public meeting. We're recording. We want to get everybody's attention. We will get everybody's input one way or another. Just give us a chance to kind of go through that. Block your own calendar for all future meeting dates, right? Like, so there's, Pam can talk through some logistics, but it's just best if you block time. If you're going to drive, block time on either side. Please do that. In general, we're going to try to keep these meetings to an hour and a half, you know, but I block, go ahead until noon so that, you know, you can eat a sandwich or something. And then again, that's part of our key success. So next slide, please. So we'll go ahead and Pam, go into sponsor role, please.
All right. I'll start off. So this isn't exhaustive of everything that I do in the background, but these are the things that are important for you as the planning group members and my engagement with you. So meeting coordination, I send out the invites, but I don't send out calendar invites. I will only send you an email, and you can always go on our website and there's a calendar invite on there that you can save and download and save. But there's a reason I don't send out calendar invites. I send that distribution list to all interested parties. There's hundreds of emails, and I blind copy as much as I can, but we've had issues in the past where that can be hijacked and it's messy. We haven't necessarily had that our planning group here, but I have in other planning groups. There's not a way around it other than forwarding those meeting invites and just I save them completely separate. I've tried different things. If you know a better way, great. So it is up to you to save your meeting notices. I will say, please read your meeting materials, because that goes out to everyone, but it has a lot of important information in there. You know, read through those meeting materials, emails, especially. Alternate coordination, you're really supposed to notify me and Alicia. The bylaws say, I think, 48 hours prior to attending in a meeting.
Go to the next slide.
Here's the meeting coordination. All right, next slide on this one. We'll stay here on this one. So this is, I'm not going to go over every place that I post our meeting notices. You can look at this slide and see that this goes out all the places. You can find our meeting noticing and by rule what we're required to do for the meeting noticing. Next slide. For the alternate contact information, make sure that I have your alternate contact information, a copy of your OMA, their Open Meetings Act training certificate on file before they serve for you in that role. You bylaws do say that you should be notifying me and the chair. I ask you to CC me, but you really just have to notify the chair, I think 48 hours prior to a meeting. We will accept it at the last minute, or at least.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you can tell us, you can tell. Even if something happens, you thought you were coming, your alternate second. It's helpful. The sooner we know, especially if we think we're gonna have a quorum issue, the better. So if it's just like I was driving there, it's just not gonna happen. I didn't have time to get an alternate. Anytime you know you're not gonna be here, it's helpful. And yeah, when in doubt, copy Pam on everything because it's Pam and she's really running all this. We're just participating. So.
I keep records of everything in the background that goes on in email. And as y'all know, I'm not perfect by some of the emails that I've sent out today. Christina, do you have a question?
Just a quick one. So the alternates, when we send them to you, do you notify them or do we have to notify them that they need to also take that training?
I've already notified them. I emailed your alternate.
And thank you.
And I know. And they're here on the call as well. So her alternate is Robert Wilson with the City of Sugar Land. So thank you for that. Is that to me? Okay, next slide is mileage reimbursement. So for voting members, if you travel to a meeting, we have money in our budget for mileage reimbursement. The only caveat to that is if you are not eligible to be reimbursed from, say, your employer. Say your employer, you know, reimburses you for mileage, you can't also get mileage from us. But if you are not eligible in yourself, you are eligible for reimbursement for your mileage. It's helpful if you let me know ahead of time and I will have the form for you ready to sign and we'll process and we do process it through a check request. It'll be a couple of weeks for you to get it, but that's, we have a process there for that. And I would just let me know. That's all I have. Do you have any other questions for me, anyone?
Whose slides are these?
Before we move on?
Oh, you haven't seen those.
It looks like it skips a bit. Did we lose some?
Did, yeah.
Yep.
I don't know. Well, there's supposed to be a couple slides before that.
Yeah, but no big deal. I can summarize.
Hold on. Or they out of order. Enter the paper. I'll flip to that real quick. Hold on. We might have lost some slides in the.
Yeah, I can slip some of the information. It's not that big of a thing.
Okay. It's a test. We're just like, hey, pop quiz, Tressa. Go ahead.
I can pull them up if you want.
Let's let her cover it and then.
Go ahead. Yeah. All right.
All right. So we're gonna go ahead and those that don't know that, and I'll let Tressa introduce herself. But she's with the Water Development Board today. She's in the room, so she's that tiny little head off to the side. Yeah. Tressa, go ahead and explain, you know, how you fit with us and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start a little bit with just the inception of the program. So after Hurricane Harvey. The Ledge met in 2019 at the 86th legislative session and adopted Senate Bill 8, so creating the regional and state flood planning programs and giving that duty to the TWDB to administer. The TWDB had already had several decades with the water planning process, and so the flood planning process was modeled partially after that. It's a bottom-up governance versus top-down, so that's what you're doing here. You're a self-governing group that makes the decisions, putting together your regional flood plans across 15 regions covering the state. And then all of those regional flood plans will come together into a single statewide flood plan. So this is just a slide showing what Alicia's already described to you. You've got your voting member designations covering interest groups, and then there's some non-voting member designations. Next slide, please. Oh yeah, that just highlights me. And then next slide. This is the current regional and state flood planning group, or your team at TWDB. So Reem June is our director, and she's the ADEA of all the planning, so water and flood. I'm the assistant director of flood planning and the interim planner for regions 8, 12, and 13. And I was previously in the state flood planner role. Kevin Wessels is the manager of the regional flood planning team. And then you can see all of our planners. Cynthia Nolasco is the new state flood planner. Next slide. So really my and all of the planners' roles are to support you in your work. So managing processes. Oh, this is TWDB role. I'm sorry, I'm skipping ahead. So yeah, sorry. We've got the Office of Planning, and under that umbrella, you've got water supply planning, flood planning. So managing your processes, allocating funding at the beginning of cycles. We also, through the state flood plan, will determine project eligibility for state funding under the Flood Infrastructure Fund. And then we put together the state flood plan. And next slide, please. So the flood planner, we attend all meetings as a non-voting and we're really here to answer any questions you may have, technical or administrative. And then on the administrative side, we process all of the payment requests that come through from the sponsor, so the Brazos River Authority. And then we meet regularly with the sponsor, the chair, and the technical consultants again to kind of keep track of progress toward that regional flood plan and answer any questions. Next slide. So what's in the future? We came out with the 2024 state flood plan last year. It's the very first state flood plan ever. And that was put together from the 15 2023 regional flood plans. So the next 2028 regional flood plans will inform the 2029 state flood plan. So as I kind of mentioned before, only those projects that are ranked in the state flood plan are eligible for state funding under the FIT program. And also the state flood plan kind of informs state legislature of the risk statewide and the needs and puts a kind of a dollar amount on that as well. And next slide. These are just some helpful links. We've got a new member page on our regional flood planning site. And you could, if you'd also like to look at the state flood plan, it's available. We have, in addition to the paper, the digital version, we've got an interactive viewer if you'd like to fiddle around with that. I think that's it. I'm always available for questions, just email me.
Thank you, Tressa. All right, so that you heard about, you know, those of us that are sort of doing a lot of logistics stuff. The rest of this time, very appropriately so, is for our consultant to go through. And now we'll take some time and get in the weeds. And this is where we're going to do our best to cover acronyms and all those little details. So this is the time to pause and ask. And we hopefully have planned for enough time for questions for you guys to get through all this. And so today, I think we're going to start with Scott.
Yep.
So I'm going to let Scott introduce himself to the group. He's also here in the room, another tiny head on this side of the table. Scott, if you'll go ahead.
Sure. Yes, I'm Scott Rushing. I'm the deputy project manager representing the consultant team with Half Associates. Half was the consultant for the first cycle as well, and we are the team for the second cycle. Agenda for our particular presentation, we'll talk about our role as consultants and our team. We'll go over just a general overview of the Lower Brazos region. As Alicia alluded to, we'll be talking about some key terms. We don't have a specific slide for that, but we'll be talking about those kind of throughout our presentation. If y'all have any questions along the way, please raise your hand. We're happy to find terms. We'll hit real briefly on the 2023 regional flood plan and then focus the majority of our time on the 2028 regional flood plan, the current cycle that we're in, and then briefly on the Flood Infrastructure Fund. Next slide. All right, next slide. So this is our technical consultant team. Half is the prime consultant. Ryan Lundeen is the project manager. He was not able to make it today. I've introduced myself already. And then Jenna Blum is also here in the room. Is also, y'all are probably familiar with her. She's assistant project manager. And then we have several other sub-consultants. Go back one, please. Yeah, we have several other sub-consultants joining us also. Friesen Nichols, Torres and Associates, Holloway Environmental and Communications, and then Susan Roth is also part of our team. Next slide.
Just real quick, for those of y'all that don't know, there's actually an RFQ process that we have to go through. And so there are, each region has the opportunity to advertise, request for consultant teams, submit qualifications, and then we make those selections in each region independently. So that's how we have Half. As they mentioned, they were the ones with us last time and it was deemed a great fit to continue forward. Go ahead.
Thanks, Alicia. And so this slide is just to kind of go over who you typically be hearing from at the regional flood planning group meetings. There are 11 major primary tasks associated with the regional flood plan. So under each person here, you'll see which tasks they're the lead for. I'm not going to go over every single one of those. But just to put a face to the name, Jenna and myself were here in the room today. Nick Boardman is with Friesen Nichols, Evan Adrian with Torres, Rachel Herr also with Half, and Ryan Londine, our project manager. And then Connor Stokes and Susan Roth, they're both helping out with communications and outreach. So let's talk about the responsibility of us as a technical consultant. Focus your attention on the center part of the screen first, on that gold portion, the technical consultant. So we are helping to provide information and guide the regional flood planning group in decision making. Off to the left, you see the community input and public data. So there's a lot of information that gets fed in through the consultant. We take in that information, we process it, and then we provide some meaningful results or information onto the regional flood planning group. This cycle, we are responsible also for performing several of the flood management evaluations. We'll get into that here in a little bit. But those are just studies that we'll be performing as a consultant team to hopefully process those into projects that can get rolled into the state flood plan. And then we develop the flood planning documents. So all the chapters that we will submit for you guys to review and make decisions on. And ultimately that gets rolled up into a regional flood plan for the Lower Brazos region that includes all the maps and backup GIS data. That's the kind of information that the technical consultant is pulling together. And then we do assist with the public engagement. And then with the regional flood planning group, y'all are also responsible for helping with some of that community input or community outreach, as Alicia alluded to earlier. But really it's making a lot of the flood planning decisions based off information that the technical consultant is providing you and bringing to you to make decisions on. And then ultimately that produces a regional flood plan, identifying the risk, flood management, and then various needs throughout the region. Next slide. So let's talk about just overview of the Lower Brazos region. So we are region 8. You can see that kind of there in the middle of the screen, kind of light red. But each region has their own regional flood planning group, their own sponsor, their own technical consultant team. Those regions are split up based off of major watersheds. So I mentioned earlier, ours is Region 8, Lower Brazos. Some of our neighboring regions are very small neighboring region there to the north, the Canadian Upper Red, Region 1 to the north. The Trinity region primarily borders the entire eastern boundary of Lower Brazos. The San Jacinto also borders kind of eastern and southern boundaries, more on the coastal side. And then Upper Brazos is our upstream neighbor. As Alicia mentioned earlier, the board decided to split that mostly for different watershed characteristics and just the general size of the basin throughout Texas. And then the Lower Colorado, Lavaca Region 10, that primarily borders the western boundary. Next slide. So for our region, Region 8, it spans from northwest of Fort Worth all the way down to the Gulf. There's 43 counties, 160 municipalities, 192 special districts with flood-related authorities. So there are a lot of stakeholders in our region. The land area is approximately 23,000 square miles. The population as of 2023 was slightly over 3 million. The image to your right shows that population density by census tract. So the darker color, the blue that you see, means that's a more heavily populated area. So you kind of north, Parker County, Johnson County, you have some more populous areas. McLennan County, Bell, and Williamson County, more in the mid portion of the basin. And then Fort Bend and Brazoria counties down in the south also have very significant population. And then there's several key cities listed there. I'm not going to read them all, but those are key cities within our region. Next slide. So the drainage characteristics for our region, about 20,000 total stream miles for major streams and rivers. So that's a lot. Some of the major streams, you can see them listed. I'm not going to read them all either, but those are the primary flooding sources in major rivers and streams in our region. There's several reservoirs throughout the region also. There's 3 water supply reservoirs and 6, I believe there's more than 6 flood control reservoirs. But the 3 water supply reservoirs you can see in green on the map to the right, and those are regulated by BRA. That's Lake Limestone, Lake Granbury, and Possum Kingdom Lake. And then there's several flood control reservoirs regulated by the Corps of Engineers. Those are shown in orange. I'm not going to list all those, but you can see those on the map. So there's a real diverse, I guess, there's a lot of diverse drainage characteristics throughout our region. And so that's going to highlight here in this next slide, please. So we made the decision with the first cycle to split the region up into four primary subregions based off of different watershed characteristics. So the four regions kind of starting off to the north there, which we're called is zone four, the orange boundary, the middle Brazos. A lot of rural, mostly rolling hills. There is flash flooding in that region, as well as the Brazos Valley, that next zone three in purple. There are some high population centers that I mentioned earlier in that region. And then there's Flash Flood Alley, as we referenced earlier. So a lot of flash flooding in both the zone four and zone three locations, along with some of the flooding along your major rivers too. That's not quite as flashy, a little more slower rising and falling along your major rivers. And then zone two, upper coastal, which is Austin and Waller counties, mostly flat and rural, widespread flood risk, primarily from streams in the Brazos River. And then zone one, coastal, very flat, very highly populated, very widespread flood risk, both urban and from primary streams. And of course, the tidal influence and hurricane and tropical storm influence as well down south in the coastal areas. Next slide. So these are some other sub-region characteristics. The image on the left shows the distribution of flood claims throughout our region. The color ramp scale, the green regions, they have less flood claims compared to the other locations. And then it kind of ramps up from yellow to orange and then ultimately red, showing where there's a significant amount of flood claims in that lower zone three and zone four along the coast. And then on the right, there's a distribution of low water crossings throughout the region also. The green regions there show where there's not as many low water crossings. There are low water crossings there, just not as many compared to the yellow, red, orange, and then ultimately the red. That's where you have the majority of your low water crossings. Next slide. I'm not going to go into detail on the rainfall or weather with these two slides, but I did want to highlight there is a difference between the lower basin and the upper basin in terms of weather patterns and rainfall. Of course, in the lower basin, you're going to get more rainfall and more precipitation due to the kind of coastal and hurricane and tropical storm influence. But there's still significant rainfall amounts kind of as you move up in the upper part of the basin. But in general, rainfall is just higher in the lower basin than than the upper basin, mostly because of the tropical storm and hurricane influence. Next slide. Touch briefly on the 2024 climate report to assess enough historic and future trends of extreme weather in Texas. Extreme rainfall intensity is expected to increase by 10% according to the report by 2036. Urban flooding throughout the state, is expected to increase also with precipitation. However, on the riverine flooding side, the increases they're projecting not to see as much anticipated increase there due to a lot of the mitigation efforts that are occurring throughout the region in the state. And then hurricane storm surges, they show will tend to be more severe due to the sea level rise and increase in hurricane strength. It's important just to know kind of that climate report that does impact some of our future, some of our decisions related to future mapping and some of the development of projects in terms of resiliency and design standards. Next slide. Okay, so this is a questions checkpoint. Does anybody have any questions so far just about the region itself? Our consultant team or the process? Christina?
Now, I don't want to monopolize the time either. I just had a couple of thoughts that came up as we were going through this. I noticed that you showed the population centers for Bell and McLennan counties, and the high parts tended to be in the middle Brazos. Was there a reason why they were included in that upper versus Yeah. So looking at that one, but then go down two slides, I think it was.
Where the region section breaks are?
There you go. Yeah. I just was there some thinking or discussion between why we put them, the population centers, in the middle Brazos versus the Brazos Valley?
I would suspect it's watershed, but honestly, when the slides came through, I had the same thought of like, do we need to evaluate that boundary? I suspect, Christina, when it was originally went through, just looking at that kind of arc, that they broke it at watershed.
Yeah.
And we may have to figure out if there's another sort of elegant spot that we could break it at the upstream watershed, because I think to your point, and you know, how the characteristics are maybe different. I mean, is that what you kind of have? You think it's probably the same thing you guys were hearing in the beginning too? So
yeah, that's definitely shed boundary delineation. If that's something we need to consider, we certainly can if that's up for discussion.
I mean, she's the expert of that area, and if you're thinking you probably are more likely like the Brazos Valley and flashy and developed, then probably
I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, we have our recommended standards for certain areas, and with a higher and more dense population, that it might lend itself towards the other. I did have one other question. You presented a slide, and it talked about the number of claims. Did we look at the actual number of flood policies to kind of put that in perspective? Because I know, for example, in our area, there's not as many policies because they're all rental units and nobody has insured them. And so I didn't know if we looked at that impact, not just the actual number of claims.
This specific map is just showing purely number of claims. I don't think we retrofit it to policies or anything to take that into account. That is a great point, as we use this in other tasks using this data to make sure we're taking that into account. Because yes, that's a big thing. Flood claims doesn't completely correspond to how much flooding you experience. But we do also look at historical flooding damages and types of things to try to account for that to some degree. But
We need to double check that data source, because a lot of times when I've seen the flood claims data source, it's irregardless of whether you had a flood policy. It's also if you got it through the disaster program, right? Which is actually where more people get paid out. That giant hotspot down there in Brandon land, like those people didn't all have flood policies. They just got whammied, right? And then between GLO and flood dollars. So I think it's definitely something that if nothing else, we need some asterisks or whatever. And then I think Sujith has some questions too. But Christina, did you have other points? Sounds like we'll definitely need to go back and look at that boundary. I think that's a great idea. And guys, this may be one where maybe it has to be a county boundary, you know, kind of an MSA break instead of a watershed break, because I think to her point of where it falls in is the recommendations. And because it is an urban area, it makes more sense maybe to be in those other urban recommendations. Mm-hmm. Sujith.
I thought this was Sam from Flood, FEMA, I think, you know, the number of claims, not necessarily the policies.
Yes.
So these are the claims from FEMA documents right there. So that could be some of the policies and some non-policy owners.
Yeah, I think so. But I think, as always, it's, you know, we can make a note and make clear what the data sets are. You know, to me, where things become most prescient, when you put these side by side and you go, the distribution of low water crossings and the distribution of claims and where those overlap, for example, where I am in Williamson County, whatever, that's not a good thing. And like, you know, how do we sort of manage some of that? But I think all good questions to make sure, because a lot of these things we're updating and tweaking in what you'll see in the next plan. Did I have any other voting members with questions on this? Because I think we're about to hit the break. I'm not sure who that is. Eric, are you on as an alternate for somebody today, for a voting member? Okay. I don't think so. So we're going to go ahead and take, it's a little bit after 11. Most of us have been at it since 10. So we're going to go ahead and take like a 5-minute break. I have 11:08 here. So whatever that math is, 11:13, we're going to be back on the screen. So if everybody wants to pause, if you will mute the room, and I know I'm going to run down. I think we're back, and hopefully you guys can hear us. Perfect. So we're going to go ahead and drop it off to Jenna, if you're ready.
Okay. So before I dive into the real nitty-gritty of everything, we wanted to give a quick overview of what we did do in the 2023 regional flood planning cycle. This is crucial because it built the foundation for what we're working off of now. And as you'll see in months going forward, we frequently reference, well, here's what we did last time, here's potential changes we could make. So having a bit of an understanding of what our process was is important. So Tressa already spoke to it some, but the 2023 cycle was kicked off in 2021. They are typically five-year planning cycles, but this was quite condensed just due to the timing of when funding was allocated and when the legislature had set the due date. So we completed our first 2023 regional flood plan in about a year and a half, delivered that to the TWDB in January of 2023. And we had those same interim submittals that we have this time, a technical memorandum and a draft regional flood plan in that year and a half window. And then right after we submitted the 2023 regional flood plan, the TWDB allocated some additional funding for us to go track down even more projects and perform some studies. So we performed an amendment in the next 6 months right after that. So that's where we actually did perform some flood mitigation or flood management evaluations, perform some regional watershed studies, identified projects, and also did an assessment of what kind of flood warning infrastructure is currently out in the Lower Brazos region and where improvements could potentially be made. So we did that right after we submitted the final flood plan. And then the TWDB took all of that information and wrapped it up into the first ever state flood plan that was completed in September of 2024. And at that time, we kicked off our second planning cycle. But in tandem to kicking off that second flood planning cycle, we also performed a second amendment to the 2023 regional flood plan. So that's where the timelines get a little bit confusing. This second amendment was done with our current cycle funding. It was done within this current cycle schedule. So it gets a little bit confusing, but we actually added all that information back to the old flood plan. It was not the creation of a new flood plan. So we did that just in this past April, a couple months ago, and the TWDB is currently reviewing it and maybe providing comments later this month. So y'all might hear about those comments. We might bring them back to ask questions on how to best address before getting that back to the Texas Water Development Board. So just a little overview of what that cycle looked like. It was very condensed, fast and furious. So there's room for improvement now that we have a little bit more time. And then on the next slide, we have a little overview, just kind of the key items we tackled with that 2023 flood plan. So the first is characterizing the region, a lot of data collection, determining what our existing and future flood risk is, establishing goals and goals for floodplain management practices, identifying needs throughout the region. And then after we felt like we had a good understanding of where our region is at, we started looking at recommending solutions. So what are projects and studies that could be implemented to help mitigate risk? What would the impacts of those projects and studies be? We summarized all of that into documentation. We made recommendations on the regulatory and legislative side on how they could improve flood planning in the state of Texas, and identified potential funding sources to implement all of these solutions. And then we performed our two amendments where we did additional outreach and coordination and identified additional evaluations and projects to put into the plan. And throughout this entire process, we were trying to encourage public participation, get communities involved. Tressa mentioned it's a bottom-up approach, which starts at the regional level, but even more so starts at the community level. We're dependent on community data and communities communicating with us on what their needs are for us to make the most accurate and helpful flood plan possible. So the public participation is really key. It's something we're always striving to do better and always appreciate any help y'all can give us by reaching out to communities that you have personal connections with or you represent and making sure their needs are put into the plan.
Jenna, if I could pause you there. Yes. So to be fair, the public participation, and this was pretty consistent across the regions, kind of wasn't great. the first round. Part of that was we're rolling out of COVID. A big part of that was because it was new. And part of that is just survey fatigue for any of you guys that are in the business for our county or like, man, do you know how many people ask me like how many of these and what do I need of that and da 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 da? Why do I care? Well, when the first FIF finally flipped over, they did it a first funding, but when the second one came in and said you don't get money unless you're in the plan, everyone went, I need to be in the plan, right? So that was a huge attention getter. So that alone, and now that people understand the process that you have to be in the plan to be eligible to get that funding, we're going to get more attention. Now, because we're in that magic 12 to 18 month window of the catastrophic losses that we have seen, we are going to get more attention. That is going to line up well with our roadshows, and we need to be prepared because we're probably also going to get attention that people are going to think we're there to fix everything, right? So a lot of it is going to be explaining what we can do, what we're supposed to do, what we need your help for, but also what we don't do, right? But I would expect almost every region that's anywhere near Central Texas area for sure is going to see a tenfold increase in public participation. So something we didn't try last time. It's just people have limited amount of time and attention and didn't realize it was valuable and didn't really understand the full impact of what this state flood plan would roll up to. And one of the important things that Tressa mentioned earlier is this is the communication with the legislature, right? Like Water Development Board had to pull it all together into one giant flood plan and then share it with the legislature. This is the need. This is the impact statewide, right? Because the legislature is the one that's going to decide money and funding and priorities. And for them, they need a larger document and to be able to see and not just hear from this rep over here and that senator over there. So it's a huge, huge document that its importance is becoming more and more. They're already speaking about it when these storms hit. Hey, well, we have a state flood plan. We could. It's going to become more and more important and people are going to become more and more reliant on it. So even these little nuances that you guys are bringing up about, do we need to adjust this here or adjust this there? Those things are going to be more important than ever because people are going to be really engaged in this document. Sorry, Jenna.
No, you're fine.
Yeah. Our public one, too. I expect to have a public 20, 30, 100 this time. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's an overview of what we did last cycle. And now I'm going to get into where are we going this cycle if there's no questions on that brief overview. Okay. More slide, please. Thank you. So the TWDB has set us a pretty defined scope of work, and it includes 11 overarching tasks. We kind of split this up into two different groupings of tasks. So tasks 1 through 4, we term characterizing the region. So these are our data collection and analysis heavy tasks. This is what we're in the midst of currently, and they culminate in a technical memorandum we submit to the Texas Water Development Board to show substantial progress. This technical memorandum is due in January of 2026. So most of these tasks we have already introduced to the group throughout this year and have gotten some at least preliminary feedback. As y'all saw earlier today, we submitted draft chapter 1 for task 1 on the planning area description, and we'll continue to submit some draft materials as they are prepared. Next year, we'll move into recommending solutions, which is tasks 5 through 11. And this is really looking at what can we do to address the needs, the risk, the goals that we've identified. There's a couple of key tasks where the regional flood planning group is able to actually take action. And then there's a lot of quantification and recommendations to determine how could communities take action and try to guide them through that process. So I'm going to be taking these tasks one at a time and describing them, giving a little information on what is the goal of the task and what are some key decisions the RFPG will need to make for us to move forward on them. And a brief overview of our timeline this time around. It is a 5-year cycle. We started it in 2024. Like I said, we're in the midst of tasks 1 through 4 to deliver that technical memorandum to the Texas Water Development Board in early 2026. And then we'll turn our attention to recommending our solutions and culminate with the draft regional flood plan in mid-2027. We'll address comments from the Texas Water Development Board and the public on that draft planning document and provide the final flood plan in 2028, which the Texas Water Development Board will wrap up with the other 14 regional flood plans to create the 2029 state flood plan. So that's our overarching view, moving towards that next submittal in January of 2026. So our first task, planning area description, is that chapter we submitted to y'all this week. And this is really a data collection task where we characterize the region. The Texas Water Development Board provides a lot of statewide databases for us to build off of. And then we supplement that with questionnaire responses from communities and our own research on other publicly available data sources from state and federal entities. And we just use it to understand who our region is, what type of flooding they experience, and what is historical data that we have available to us. And this is a real foundation for a lot of the tasks we do in the future. This performs, it gives us that data foundation. Task 2A is where we assess existing flood risk. This is where we get into some of our technical terminology that you'll hear us as the technical consultants throw around a lot. I'm going to try to define these as I go through them, but please feel free to flag if there's anything I say that doesn't mean anything without a definition, and I could stop and explain a little bit better. So under this Task 2A assessment of existing flood risk, we form a flood quilt. We do not develop models. We go out and we gather available flood risk data sets. They can be regional data sets. They can be community submittals of communities that said, here's a model we made for our area. They can be statewide data sets. And we determine in any given area what is the best data set available and use that. And we use that to quantify what is the flood risk for the 10%, 1%, and 0.2% annual chance storm events. These are statistical design storm events that have a given percent chance of happening in any year. So the 10% out of these three is the most frequent. It's the smallest precipitation, and it has a 10% chance likelihood of happening in any given year. So even if it happens this year, it's still a 10% chance of happening next year. And this is based on historical data. They project it out and they develop a statistical analysis projecting what the percent likelihood of having different precipitations are within the state. And then we do this for the 1% and 0.2% annual chance events as well. So we'll have a flood quilt for each one of those that takes the best data in any given area and stitches it together, which is why we call it the flood quilt. And we use this information to see what is our existing flood risk to infrastructure. How many buildings are we showing being in this 1% annual chance event area? How much population, low water crossings, critical facilities, all that type of information. And then we also look at what is the vulnerability of these communities with high flood risk. Primarily leaning on the Social Vulnerability Index for this, which is a national data set that defines the characteristics of a community to kind of define how able are they to respond to a disaster. Do they have reliable infrastructure? Are they a more vulnerable demographic that will not have the money or the means to respond to a disaster, to kind of identify maybe you have high flood risk and you're also not able to respond well to a disaster. That could be a very key area to target. And on the next slide, we kind of show what does this layering look like for our flood quilt. So we get all these various data sources and piece them together across a watershed. So to highlight some of these key data sources, we do rely on the FEMA National Flood Hazard data set, which is the regulatory data set that many people are familiar with. It's what's used for insurance purposes and regulation. We use that where it is recent and updated. We also use base level engineering, which was created by the Texas Water Development Board. It's available throughout the state. Models to assess flood risk. There is varying levels of the detail of the models throughout our region in particular. Some of them are less detailed and some areas have more detailed base level engineering models. And then our kind of base layer that we use to fill in any gaps is Fathom. And this is a statewide data set that the Texas Water Development Board procured. And it's a coarser data set. It does provide a comprehensive flood risk analysis, but it is a more high-level assessment. So typically community models or base level engineering is more detailed and captures more detail in the terrain and flood infrastructure, that type of information. So we prioritize it, but Fathom provides a good base layer where people just don't have any assessment information. And it does include riverine, coastal, and urban flood risk in that data set. Task 2B is kind of similar to Task 2A, but we're just looking at future condition flood risk. So looking at what is our flood risk in 2060 versus what is our flood risk today. It is a little bit more of a complex task just due to the availability of data. There are community models and regional models for most of the state that are great, but most of them do not assess future flood risk. That's not a common item to assess. So we have a few different ways we're attacking this task, and this is something we have discussed with the group extensively this cycle already, and we've gotten approval from the Texas Water Development Board to move forward with our attack plan, but we will be presenting these draft flood quilts for y'all for comment, and we can make revisions as needed. But some of the approaches we're using this cycle for future flood risk, one is we're updating regional models that we know are detailed, good regional models. We're using some of these assumptions on rainfall, future sea level, future subsidence. And we're running these regional models and creating future data sets. Another approach we're using is a vertical buffer. This one's a little bit more complex to try to explain. So the visual aid is really helpful here. So for the vertical buffer, what we do is we look at in existing conditions, what is the difference between the depths experienced in the 1% and 0.2% annual chance events? And we project that over to future. So in future conditions, the larger storm of the 0.2% annual chance event becomes the future 1% annual chance event. And then we maintain that vertical buffer. Let's say there was a foot of difference between those storms and existing conditions. We add that foot of difference over in future conditions and we buffer that up. And then we project that vertical buffer and see, according to the terrain, how far out will that push our flood extents. So 1 foot of difference in the coastal areas in Brazoria and Fort Bend County might push out your flood extents by several hundred feet. When you look at the northern portion of the basin, maybe it only pushes it out a couple feet where you have some more topography. So we're using that where data is available to really quantify depths versus just extents. And then anywhere where we don't have regional models or data to quantify depths, we're filling in with future Fathom, which again is comprehensive and does include everything, but is just a more coarse data set and not as detailed as these other approaches. So we're using it as a fill-in for anywhere else. So these are two pretty complex tasks. They are probably the most technical tasks that we do, and it's where a lot of the buzzwords come in, a lot of the definitions. So I just, if anybody has any buzzwords that I just used that I need to define further, or if there's anything I can explain a little bit more here, I'm happy to do so before we proceed.
You've got about 20, 25 minutes.
Okay. Fantastic. Okay, I'll move forward into our next task. So task three is split into three subtasks, 3A, 3B, and 3C. And I like to think of these as identifying where does our region need to be. We know now we've assessed existing flood risk, we've gathered data, and now we need to see where our region should be. So we're really setting out some goals for ourselves and some targets for communities to consider as they progress. So task 3A is floodplain management practices. This is the technical memorandum we submitted to y'all for review this week. So feel free to go read that and get a better understanding of this task than this brief overview. But what we do for this task is we look at what practices are currently done by entities within the region. And then we recommend or adopt target standards for the region and those subregions that Scott had gone over earlier in this presentation. So there's this difference between recommending and adopting. If we recommend, it's just putting it out there. We as an RFPG thinks this is a great target. This would help y'all manage flood risk within your entity, within your community. Please go do it if you're able. Adopting is the way that the RFPG can try to kind of force communities to meet the standards. Adopting means a community would have to meet all of these standards before they could have their needs incorporated into the plan. Historically, our RFPG has opted not to adopt, found it not to be our role. There are exceptions in every case of why a community might not be able to meet these target standards. They might not have the funding, the means. A standard might not be applicable to them for one reason or another. So we've opted to not adopt previously, and that's what we're carrying forward as of now. But as y'all review that memorandum we submitted, you're welcome to bring that back for discussion if that's something you're really passionate about. Next task is task 3B, and this is our needs analysis. So this is really heavily dependent on our task 2A flood risk quantification, where we saw what infrastructure is currently at risk, and also task 1, where we gathered all of our other data, our historical data, where are there flood risk maps, where are there hydraulic models. And we identify where are the areas within our region that have the highest flood risk. We do this on a watershed basis. And just kind of to quantify and target our efforts to these areas of highest flood risk, it's informative for future tasks to have this information available. And then where are areas where we don't even feel confident that we know what the flood risk is? Maybe we only have Fathom out there and we think it could be missing something. So this is a great task. It's heavy on the data analysis, but it's brought back frequently for subsequent tasks as a reference so we can really target our future efforts. And then task 3C is outlining flood mitigation and management goals. This is kind of similar to the standards task, but a little bit more broad. There's no adoption forcing people to meet these goals. This is us looking at what could our region do to improve. So this can be mitigation efforts. It can also be management efforts. So an example here would be we identify a goal topic. Maybe we want to reduce flood risk to critical facilities within the region. We establish a baseline measurement. Our task 2A flood quilt said there are 600 critical facilities currently at 1% annual chance flood risk. We determine a short-term goal. In 10 years, we think the region should target reducing the amount of critical facilities at flood risk by 10%, and we determine a long-term goal. In 50 years, we should reduce it by 50%. And we just kind of set that out there. Again, it's used to notify communities what the regional flood planning group thinks should be important. It's not something we're able to enforce. But it is something we can keep in mind as we do other tasks on what are our goals, maybe where should we focus more of our effort. And then I'm about to get into tasks 4 and 5, but I'm about to use a bunch of acronyms. So I want to define those real quick beforehand to give y'all a fighting chance, because I know it's a lot. So when we talk about flood mitigation needs, there's some really specific categories that are critical to kind of understand. And these align with that matrix that we showed earlier in our technical consultant update when we're kind of separating needs into different buckets. So we have 3 buckets. The first and probably easiest to understand is on the right side, flood mitigation project. These are constructible, fully developed projects. They do need to meet a specific checklist to qualify to be in this category. They need to prove that implementing the project will not create negative impacts to neighboring areas. They need to be able to quantify what the cost of the project would be and what the benefits of the project would be. Are you removing 5 houses from flood risk? All of that quantification has to already be done to fit into this group. So it's a very set list of items. Items like channel improvements, road crossing improvements, detention projects, engage installation, all fully constructible projects that you just need to get money for so you can go out and start digging in the field. Flood management evaluations over on the left are your studies. So when we think of this, we typically think of master drainage plans, regional watershed studies, understanding risk, and identifying potential solutions. But it can also be projects that just haven't been fully vetted yet. Maybe you know you need to go improve a road crossing, but you haven't determined, is that going to cause negative impacts and how do I prevent that? You might classify that as an FME, so you can perform that last bit of study to get it to meeting this FMP checklist. So in the meantime, it's classified as an FME, an evaluation. And then finally, the category in the middle is an FMS, which is a flood mitigation strategy. And this is kind of a catch-all for anything else. It's not a technical study, and it's not a project that I'm going to go put in the field. So it can be non-technical studies where maybe you're assessing, we want a flood warning system, but we aren't sure where best to place gauges or how to develop an interface. It can also be more regulatory or management side of things, developing a drainage criteria manual, providing a property acquisition buyout program, that type of thing. So it's a catch-all. It's kind of a weird section for anything else that it's not a technical study, not a project. So now I'll dive into tasks 4 and 5. So 4A is this FMX identification. I'm sorry, I was supposed to identify one more acronym. FMX is how we group those three items together. FME, FMS, and FMP all together, FMX. So task 4A is that FMX identification. This is where communities can tell us, we want to perform a drainage master plan. We want to go do a channel improvement. We gather that data in, we evaluate it, we fill out a table that says, here's the description, here's the estimated cost, here's who wants to move it forward, and here's what the benefits might be. And we did this in the previous plan, of course, but like Alicia had mentioned, we did struggle a little bit with public engagement. So we also went and did a bunch of our own research. So you can see this table on the left. Last cycle, we went out and we collected a bunch of items from publicly available documents like master drainage plans, hazard mitigation plans, CIP lists, and listed them. And we got about 400 listings from that. We did have some communities reach out and tell us what their needs were. And of course, we included those in the plan and got about 200 submittals from that effort. And then the RFPG also identified some necessary FMEs and FMPs through our efforts, through our needs analysis, where we said this area has really high flood risk. Maybe you need to go do a flood risk assessment or a master drainage plan to identify projects. So we totaled almost 800 listings last cycle. And the majority of that was FMEs, those evaluations, but there were a substantial number of FMPs and FMSs. And then we had this infeasible group, which are those concepts that maybe we found or somebody brought to us, but we looked at them and we realized they really aren't regional floodplain solutions. Maybe they are mitigation efforts for development, or they're really small, but they don't really fulfill what our goals are with this plan. So these four tasks, tasks 1 through 4A, culminate in task 4B, which on the next slide, thank you, which is the technical memorandum, which we're going to submit to the Texas Water Development Board in January of 2026, like I said. This technical memorandum is not a full report, but it does include all of our backup data for these tasks that we've gathered to date, and it will have a brief write-up describing what we've done, what decisions we've made, and it just provides the Texas Water Development Board with a check-in point to make sure we're on the right track. Again, I want to pause here real quick. If anybody has any questions, these are the tasks we've introduced to the group already and are in the midst of. So these are crucial. If you feel like you need more background to discuss these tasks in upcoming meetings, I can provide that as needed.
And then, yeah, I think it's a good place to pause. Like she said, these are the ones we've already been through, so it's crucial to have these. Based on the timing, we're going to have to skim through the next ones, but these are all future things that we're all going to go through collectively going forward. So even though she's going a little bit faster pace, she won't read everything on the slides. Y'all can go through the slides on your own. These other tasks you'll see later on, and we'll all get a full introduction. So let's go a little bit faster and see where we go.
Okay. So Task Force C, FME performance, this is a great task. This is an opportunity for the RFPG to really take action. This is where we will get to actually perform some of these flood management evaluations. There's two large buckets that we do here. One is data gap reduction, regional watershed studies, looking at areas where they don't have the funding, the means, the staffing to perform a watershed study to assess their own flood risk. We can go in, do it for them, provide them that data. The other is elevating those almost FMPs to full FMP status so they can go get that construction funding. So this will bring back, again, this will be a key decision point for the regional flood planning group to really provide your input on how we want to take action within our region. Next task is task 5A, recommendation of FMXs. So in this task, we take everything that we gathered in, all of the FMEs, FMPs, FMSs, and we decide what do we want to formally recommend. Only these recommended items will actually be eligible to apply for funding. Only the recommended items are wrapped into the state flood plan. The non-recommended live only in our regional flood plan as listings. They are not carried forward into that state flood plan. So historically, one of our crucial criteria here is just making sure the sponsor is engaged before we recommend. We do not want to recommend items that sponsors have zero awareness of that we just went and gathered from an old planning document and cause a riot in their city when somebody goes and reads it and says, oh, why aren't you implementing this? So historically, we've just required that a sponsor step up and send us an email, give us a phone call saying we are interested in doing this. That's all it takes. And then we can move it over to that recommended list. And then task 5B is kind of in line with task 4C, where we're performing some FMEs. We also get to set a list of FMEs for the Texas Water Development Board to perform. So this is what Tressa was talking about earlier in her update during our formal RFPG meeting. They provided some additional guidance that the Texas Water Development Board is looking to prioritize performing FMEs for rural and underserved communities. So that will be crucial as we're developing that list to make sure we're fitting into that criteria. That is what we had done in our previous cycle, so it aligns really with this group's goals, but we just need to make sure we're carrying that forward. So we'll set these FMEs, we'll send a scope of work to the Texas Water Development Board. They'll go perform these FMEs and bring us back any data and projects that they develop through these efforts, and we can include them in our plan. And then after these tasks, everything else is just kind of wrapping up the plan. So task 6A is impacts of the plan. It's really just quantifying if you perform your FMPs, what happens. So it's just a data analysis task. Task 6B, looking at is there any interaction with water supply? Really looking only at the grand scale here, not the nitty gritty. Are we affecting reservoirs or aquifers? You can see here the water planning groups do adhere to different boundaries than the flood planning because they're based on jurisdictional. So we primarily overlap with Brazos G and H, but with several other regions as well. Task 7 is flood response and activities. This is just a research and summarizing task. We are prohibited from performing analysis or planning for disaster response. We can only summarize what entities currently do for disaster response, but we do perform research to see what their processes currently are for entities within our region. And task 8 is where we get to voice our opinion on how the process could be better. We can voice recommendations to the legislative of how they should make funding available for flood planning. We can also voice our opinion on regulations, if there should be statewide standards and policies or statewide databases and tracking methodologies. And then we can also voice our opinion to the Texas Water Development Board on how they can improve the flood planning process in future years. So this will be a great something to think about throughout on how could this process improve. And task 9 is where we do some research on how might we implement these FMXs. Of course, everybody wants to tap into the flood infrastructure fund. That's why they're putting their entries into the plan. But there are other grants and assistance programs out there on both the federal and state level. So we do some research on what those available items are, We try to align them with the FMXs listed in the plan, what would potentially be eligible for this grant. And then we also reach out to sponsors and ask them if they typically use any of these funding sources to implement FMXs within their region. So we can kind of quantify that, and the state legislature can see what types of funding sources are used for flood mitigation and what is that gap that they need to fill in with the flood infrastructure fund. And then task 10 is our public engagement. I've talked about this already, so I won't go over it again too much. But if you go to the next slide, I did want to advertise. We are doing our roadshow, public roadshow soon. It's an informative, engaging process where we have an open house. Members of the public can come in and interact with our team. We'll stop at 5 areas throughout the region to try to distribute and be close to everybody at some point. And we'll have plenty of our materials from the data collection and analysis we've done so far for them to look at and provide comment on.
You send these out to the voting members in a separate email, all that detail, because I don't know if they were quite set yet.
Yeah, they are.
Okay.
Coming out.
Yep. Cool. Perfect. Next.
And then task 11 is just comparing to the previous regional flood plan. What did we do last time? What did we do different this time? And this is the schedule you've probably seen in months past, and you'll continue to see at least through the end of the year, just tracking our progress. As you can see, we're in the midst of tasks 1 through 4A, working towards that submittal to the TWDB in 2026. And this is outlining some key decisions that we're going to be bringing to you over the next few months. I've talked about these all already, so I won't talk about them again, but it's a good reference just as you're looking through materials and thinking about the different tasks. These are what's going to be coming up for discussion next, where we'll really be looking for y'all's feedback to help us direct our efforts. And that is a
whirlwind.
A whirlwind.
I'll let you take a pause. Thank you very much. So we probably won't go into those last slides about funding. We can cover that another time. We're also going to be looking to sort of restructure how we present in the meetings and really focus on, there'll be an introduction topic and it'll be clear we're introducing it this time and it's going to come back the next time and it's a decision. We're not going to continue to rehash sort of the same stuff over and over. We figured out that doesn't really add value to most of the voting members. So there'll be some generally an introduction of a topic, the in-depthness to make sure we can analyze it, and then it'll follow by voting. And so we'll actually try to start, I want them to either on footers or something, start making it more obvious of this is a decision topic today, this is an introduction topic, so that as you're following along, and then sort of once that topic's done, then it's, unless somebody needs a separate offline discussion, we are going to move on. As you can see by necessity of the schedule, there's 6 things overlapping at a time. But it is not helpful, at least I haven't found for me and several of the other voting members I've talked to juggle and discuss them all at the same time. That's hard for us. So we're going to restructure a little bit how we bring forward. And as always, if you have ideas or thoughts, you know, ping Pam and me, even if it's simple things, like if it's whatever, we have new members. If somebody's colorblind and we need to know about that, you know, let us know if you're having trouble with some of that stuff. But we're going to continue to represent the information better, because my number one priority is to make sure the voting members understand it and are getting what they need. The next level is sort of all of this stuff is feeding into what really is the public effort. So appreciate everybody's time today. Like I said, we're not going to go through those last couple slides, which is, you know, kind of buffer we had if we had time, which we don't. Thoughts, questions? Jenna did an amazing job. Does anybody have anything else that maybe we didn't cover that you hoped we would cover and that we can stash in another meeting?
Excuse me. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure. If...
Oh, this is Eric Duhon. I am substituting for Lori Boudreaux from Simonton. I'm a city council member. And earlier you asked, who is this guy? So now I'm going to identify myself. And I appreciate all of the information you've shared. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Sujit, did you have anything you want to add? Okay. Any of our board, voting members online, Bruce, Christina, especially for getting the new stuff. Anything from you guys? Charlotte, is it sort of meet what you would wish you would have had 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, this was good, and I'm glad I sat through it just even to help kind of refocus for this next cycle.